Okay, I'm going to call the working group on reentry to order. We are taping the meetings, even though we're taping the meetings, so if comments and questions could come to the chair, I think it would be helpful. And we have some new people here, so everyone probably knows each other, but let's just quickly go around, and if you could say who you are and who you represent, that would be helpful. Judge, why don't you start?
I'm Isabel Gomez from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Thank you.
Dennis Benson, Deputy Commissioner for Corrections. Jeff Shorba, Deputy State Court Administrator of the Judicial Branch. Gary Johnson with the Services, the Department of Corrections.
Jack Davies, Emeritus.
Rob Eastland, State Rep from District 17A.
Melanie Lacombe, Committee Administrator for the Public Safety Finance Division of the House.
Representative Tamar.
State Senator Linda Higgins.
Kevin Cuyer with the Board of Public Defense.
Andy Erickson, Deputy Director for Adult Probation in Ramsey County.
Ron Weiberg, Hennepin County Community Corrections.
John Stewart, State Public Defender.
Bill Carruthers with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office.
Sarah Wolf with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office.
Okay. Well, we have a full agenda today. This is our last meeting of the working group. I was also hopeful that we could spend maybe 20 minutes. I'd like us to conclude at 5 o'clock, but to spend maybe 15 or 20 minutes at the end of the meeting and just talk about what we've discussed so far and where we might want to go vis-a-vis any kind of legislation for the next session. And some members of the working group have provided Melanie with ideas. And so if you do have any ideas for legislation, please email those to Ms. Lacombe. So today's session, we're going to be talking about parole violations and sort of the high famine, I guess, the high number of technical violations that are resulting in offenders being housed in our county facilities as well as in our state institutions, and trends that have happened and see where we might want to go. So pleased that we have Gary Carger from House Research to walk us through this. And Gary, you've got a handout too, I think, that's in the packet. So that's what you're going to go after for us?
Yes.
Okay. Huh? Did I say House Research? Fiscal analyst for the Public Safety Finance Committee. So,
thank you for the promotion.
So, Mr. Carger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary Carger, fiscal analyst with the Hall of Fame. Basically, what I'm going to be doing today is going to be giving you a lot of numbers, statistics, and I think what you're going to see, you're going to be reinforced by why you have this working group after reviewing some of these numbers. We're including supervised release, what a lot of states are calling parole, and we're also including probation because I think the focus here is on prisons and jails. A lot of the probationers that are going to be in some of these statistics are coming from jails. So we're going to just go over briefly the first two pages and get into a little more detail on the probably the third. But just some statistics. Number of adults on parole or supervised release here in Minnesota at the year end. Basically, you can see from all states that from 1990 to 2005, there was about a 56.2% increase. In Minnesota, it was 133% increase. Also, that goes along with, I think, with the population of the prison population. And Dennis, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think from 1990 to 2005 showed about a 179% increase in our prison population. Minnesota probation population, this is from the Corrections Probation Survey, the 2006 survey. You can see in 1995, and this is as far as they went back on their survey, close to 100,000. Right now, the last survey showed a little over 142,000. And that's relates or brings in there or shows a 42.8% increase. Next, we're going to show some statistics on recidivism. These are the Bureau of Justice statistics, and this is on, once again, recidivism. These are, you're going to see these statistics quoted in almost every reentry article or book. The first one, and I should start off, it's probably the most comprehensive study that has ever been done on reentry. They looked at states, and I think most of the population is included in here. Minnesota was also included in these numbers. And they showed that in 1983, you're going to see the rearrests. These were, after 3 years, people released from prison, rearrests for a new offense, 62.5%. Back in prison for a new crime or for a technical violation, it was 41.4%. I should also point out that this is a fairly valid study because they also looked at statistics in other states. In other words, if you were released from Minnesota, but you got picked up in Wisconsin and violated in Wisconsin and then were sent to a Wisconsin prison, they're going to include you. I should also point out that these studies like this are very expensive to do and also take a lot of time. They also say they may underestimate the population because you're going to have some people that are going to be on a suspense file or they can't match the fingerprint card with the individual, so there may be some undercounting. The 1994 study, rearrests 67.5% and 51.8% are back in prison after 3 years. Now, from this, we have the 1997 Minnesota Legislative Auditor's Report, and this showed that inmates released in 1992. And their report goes along somewhat with what the Bureau of Justice Statistics findings were. Rearrest for a new offense, 64%. Reconviction or reconvicted for a new crime, 45%. Resentenced to prison for a new crime, 28%. And back in prison for a new crime or a technical violation, 40%. Just I want to point out, this is a study for extra reading. If somebody wants to do reading, it's a very good study. They went through a lot of detail, good background material. I should also point out that they also did a study on juvenile recidivism. I think this group, you've mentioned several times about juveniles, you know, looking at their reentry program. They showed, and they looked at Red Wing, they looked at the Hennepin Homeschool, they looked at Boys Totem Town, and they found the percent with delinquency petitions or adult arrest, and this is from the juvenile study, for Red Wing after 3 years, was 71% for Red Wing, the Hennepin Homeschool was 76%, Boys Totem Town was 77%. The percent adjudicated delinquent or convicted as an adult, it was 62% for Red Wing, 59% for the Hennepin Homeschool, and 61% for Boys Totem Town. Now, the DOC's latest numbers, they're showing from the Red Wing facility, there's a 53% reconviction rate and a 38% reincarnation rate. Now, once again, these may be a little underreported because I do not think Corrections is looking at arrests or reconvictions in other states. Okay, page 3 of the report. The first one is Department of Corrections recidivism. This is coming from their report that they do every 2 years from the performance report. They're showing a reconviction rate of 36% and a reincarnation rate of 25%. Once again, this might be a little undercounted because of the limited review that it doesn't pick up the information from other states. I think the Bureau of Justice Statistics, they're saying that if you include other states, it could be somewhere from 4 to 7%, you know, 4 to 7% increase. Okay, next we're going to go to the 2006 admissions to the Department of Corrections. Now, this information came from sentencing guidelines, and I think it was cleared. We cleared this with the department to make sure we're on the same boat. Short-term offenders, you see that new court commits with those 15%. Probation revocation is 85%. So there's a total there that are going right now to the local jails or workhouses, about 1,342. The non-short-term offenders, new courts commit 40%. Probation revocation 21%. And supervised release returns 31%. The totals there are on the right. Excuse me, the non-short-term offenders were 40%, 21%, 38%. If you take the total and you include the short-term offenders with the, you know, in the total, you're going to have a new court commits of 35%, probation revocations of 33%, and supervised release returns of 31%. Now, Isabel Gomez presented the 1980 study, I think it was at a committee in February or March that the House had. And this had a lot of members thinking about this, because they showed that the new court commits in 1980 were 76%, probation revocations were 7%, and supervised release returns were 17%. So you're looking at the supervised release returns going from 17% of the new admissions now to either 38% or 31%, depending if you factor in the short-term offenders. Travis, in his book, which is a very interesting book on reentry, I recommend it for everyone. He has one of his subtitles here is The Explosion of Parole Revocation. This also varies by state. I think Minnesota is somewhat in the middle, according to some of the charts that we have. California, though, over 70% of those that are on parole will be back in prison within 30 or 3 years. Just very high numbers. Now, we also, I put on here the short-term offenders, because I think this is important, too, that because this affects the jail population. A lot of these people are coming back for, you know, they're probation violators, but also what reentry services are being provided to this group of people. I sit in on a group of short-term offenders, and what we're finding out there is that there's very little in reentry services for this group. In fact, one of the members of the group called this the lost men, somewhat of a sexist term, because I think 20% of these are females, but that nobody wants them. Corrections doesn't want them. The local jails, they don't want them. And services, very little in services. Now, I think we're going to, you have some of the numbers there, that too, the increase that you're looking at from when it started. In fiscal year 04, there's about a 52% increase in the short-term offenders, and this is once again has the impact on the counties. Okay, I just put on here, too, some average lengths of stays. A lot of members are interested in this. For new commitments, the average length is 39 months. Probation violators, 16 months. Supervised release violators, 5 months. And short-term offenders, it's about 3.5 months. The average time they're spending either in jail or in prison. With the short timers and even with supervised release, I think we've been hearing it is very hard to program for these individuals. Also on this, I just want to point out for recidivism, in 1980, state prisons admitted approximately 27, now this is nationwide, approximately 27,000 parole violators. According to Travis, in 2000, the same states admitted over 200,000 parole violators, with over a sevenfold increase. Now, we're going to get into some of the reasons. What are the costs to this and why? The cost, I did a rough estimate for those individuals that are on, you know, in the above for probation and release violators, for the ones that were admitted in 2000. And I came up, the cost for this for 1 year, for those, some of them are going to be over a year, some are going to be less than a year. Costing corrections using their per diem that the statute says they have to report, over $93 million in state costs. Even if you use the marginal per diem, which is about $55, which they would use for bed savings, it's around over $51 million. Now, I guess the other question is, why is this happening? Some of the research that we have been doing, well, first of all, let me point out that one of them said that virtually no one in government can spend like a parole officer. And I guess one of the reasons is that there's no budget for these individuals. You know, they can commit these people to prison, and you're looking at a cost of from $80 to $100 a day. And also, I just want to point out, too, that first statement under the, when the beginning of the article, if I can find that, on the beginning of the chart, the probation and parole, one of the most misunderstood components of the criminal justice system. This is what a lot of the literature is saying right now. So, why is this happening? According to some of the men, now I don't know about in Minnesota here, these are what the people that are looking at this at a national, you know, on the national level. Well, first of all, they say, first question for policymakers is, does this increase in the supervised release violators and probation violators increase public safety? I don't know. They speak on violations. Now, the other reason for this, for the increase, a lot of them are saying is that violations are being used as a primary tool of supervision and monitoring for many agencies. It results in reliance on prison as a primary sanction. There's been a recent study of parole officers, and that they're showing that most of them are giving a high priority to law enforcement function rather than to services of such as rehabilitation. I remember Harley Nelson spoke at one of our groups one time, and he said that when he started out 20 years ago, he was at Ramsey County, now he's Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. He said that the probation officer, one of his duties, he was more like a social worker. He said now they're almost more like a police officer. So just some food for thought. Other items is risk avoidance, you know, revoke parole when the first signs of failure appear. And I think we're seeing this, you know, the short-term offender meetings we have. Short-term offenders also have the option of placing these individuals on electronic monitoring or work release. But from talking to some of the sheriffs, we're finding out they don't want to do this because, as one said, well, what happens if this person commits a crime? You know, or it's a very terrible crime. We also heard Ron, I think, Ron Weiberg, when he was asked the question of why sex offenders aren't in your program, the housing program, which is a very good program, very low recidivism. The reason was that, well, what happens if one of these individuals commits a crime, and the program probably goes away. There's also spending reduction. Travis says there's more resources that have gone into building more prison beds, making fewer funds available for probation and supervised release. There's a growing caseload. I think we're seeing that, some of the caseloads that are very, very high for probation and parole officers. The other item they're talking about is new surveillance capabilities. You have drug testing, electronic monitoring. They give the agents more, they can detect some of these violations a lot quicker. So basically, that is my presentation, Mr. Chair, and I will stand for questions. And I think you were also going to have at the end, when everybody's done, sort of like what some other states are doing as far as reducing this.
I've asked Mr. Carter to do some research on some innovations that are happening around the country, but can you go back to this $93 million? Are you saying that that is the cost to the state for offenders who are having their probation revoked? Or did I misunderstand that?
Mr. Chair, that is for supervised release violators that are going back to prison and probation violations. You know, those that are violating and going to prison. Now, these are very rough numbers. We haven't checked with corrections, but what I did is basically I took the numbers from sentencing guidelines, and we took the per diem times the number of days, their average length of stay, and that's the numbers we came up with.
And that's $93 million a year?
A year. Or no, it's for those that were admitted to in 2006, so some of these are going to have a longer sentence. Or for example, if I can find the page here. So in other words, for probation violators, average length of stay is 16 months. So I took 16 months times the per diem times the number. And the same thing with the supervised release violators, their average length of stay is 5 months. So I see Mr. Benson also had his hand. He may want to comment on this.
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carger, I think you mentioned that you're using the per diem that the statute requires us to report in the performance report, correct?
Yes.
Which also includes capital costs, which is not the per diem that we ordinarily report. Capital cost is around $100, $90 per diem. I think the other per diem you mentioned is around $50 million, which is still a high number. But the per diem that we use ordinarily is the daily costs and health care and central office costs, which is around $85 a day now.
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, the reason we use that is that's the per diem that is in statute. And also in your, the corrections did a challenge incarceration report and, you know, for cost savings. They also use the higher per diem in that report, along with the you know, the marginal cost, $55 million. Now you probably can't see that, but if we use the $80 a day, I think it's 85 or for the fiscal year 06, the total would be somewhere around $75 million for those individuals.
Okay, and I just want to go back to and the reasons again. Could you just run through those real quickly? Why there's been such a dramatic increase in violations?
Well, I think some of the experts are saying, and I don't know if this pertains to Minnesota. This is on the national, and I think we may find out some of this from some of the people that will be testifying after I complete mine. That they're saying there's been a change in the philosophy out there. For some of these increases, where once again the parole officer may have been more of a social worker to help these individuals, now they're revoking them and they're sending them to prison. One of the experts, I think it was Travis or one of this other individual, said it's like shooting fish in a barrel. If you get mad at some of these individuals, it's very easy to revoke them. You also have, the resources probably have been reduced. We're seeing, I think, high caseloads for probation officers and supervised release agents. The lack of funding. I think it was Joan, and I can't remember how to pronounce her name, but Stroller or something like that. She says that the average cost for a probation person is somewhere around $1,200 a year. But if you want to provide the appropriate treatment and services to that individual, it's between $12,000 to $15,000.
Thank you. Mr. Weber?
Just a couple of points, Mr. Chairman. I concur with Mr. Carter's comments about money could probably be better spent in the community working with these people. One of the problems is that while they are incarcerated, we would like to get the treatment/rehabilitation process started. We can't do that, at least at the county level, unless we use all local tax dollars, because they are prohibited from participating in any federal financial participation program. We did change that around a little bit at the state last session when the eligibility was suspended, not terminated, so it helps a bunch. But what we need to do is get these reentry services started within the institution and then continue them when they get out, kind of a seamless delivery of service system here. We can't do that under current state law and state Department of Human Services policies. The other point I'd like to make is that while the caseloads have gone up, as Mr. Carter indicated, and the number of resources has not at the number of resources at the community level has not increased with the same proportional increase as our caseloads have increased because of lack of funding. Anybody that we do recommend for violation, for revocation on a supervised release basis, we do have guidelines we have to follow from the State Department of Corrections, and the ultimate decision to return somebody to prison lies with the Commissioner of Corrections, not with the parole officer or the supervised release officer. Gary is absolutely correct. With caseloads of 100 or more, there is frustration, etc. But I think that we need to take a look at the process and the guidelines and the rules that we have to follow in making recommendations on whether or not to revoke.
Just two quick questions about that, then. What statute is prohibiting you from providing those services?
This is an issue that's primarily at the federal level, but it involves state interpretation. There is a rule, there's a federal rule of 42 CFR 135.1009 that specifically prohibits federal financial participation on the part of anybody who is an inmate of a public institution. And so we're working on getting that changed in Washington. In fact, there's a bill that's being introduced right now to get that changed. But at the state level, Mr. Chairman, we do have the issue of under current law, GAMC follows a recipient when he or she goes to jail. Now, with DHS converting from GAMC to MnCare, we need to make sure that when the MnCare system is put into place, that their eligibility to continue to receive MnCare while they are incarcerated, as has been the practice for the past 10 years under GAMC, we want to make sure that continues. So we may have to take a look at some statutes on that.
And I just want to understand the process, too. I mean, are you saying that the probation officer, the parole officer, does not make a recommendation to the hearing officer?
Mr. Chairman, the supervised release agent does, in fact, make a recommendation to the hearings officer for a revocation. That is correct. But the ultimate decision on returning them to prison lies with the State Department of Corrections, not with the appeal.
Thank you. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one thing that struck me about Mr. Carger's numbers is that the average supervised release returnee only goes back for 5 months. And that just doesn't seem like a very cost-effective thing to do, in the sense that it can't possibly create much benefit for public safety by returning somebody for 5 months. And it's an expensive process, and it's going to be difficult to have programming to help change somebody who's going back for 5 months. So that was a surprise to me. Secondly, I wanted to suggest that other people probably know this. There's an organization called the Vera Institute of Justice that has done a lot of reports on parole and reentry that has an excellent website. I know they've done some consulting with the Department of Corrections in the past. They've done a lot of good work on reentry. Finally, I would say one thing that's going on in some other states is that they've established reentry courts, where instead of going back to prison, the person is meeting with a team of people under the supervision of a judge every week. Now, that would cause quite a few changes in our legal system to have a reentry court, but it's modeled on the drug courts, which have been rather successful in working with people that have these kinds of persistent problems.
And Mr. Carger is going to address that at the conclusion of our meeting here. Representative Eastland, then we're going to move on to the next presenter.
I'm just kind of thinking about a comment that has been made here at the table. How often, if a supervising officer makes the recommendation, but it is the final decision is made by the department, how often is the supervising officer decision vetoed? How often is he overridden and the inmate is not returned?
Who are you asking the question?
Anybody that would have that information. I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Would you like to come up, please, and address that?
I'm the next presenter.
Oh, come on up. All right. This will be a perfect segue. We'll maybe you can just, why don't you go ahead, Mr. Peterson, and introduce yourself and go ahead and explain the process a little bit so we understand it better. Thank you, Mr. Carter.
And Mr. Chairman, committee members, invited guests, audience, interested parties, my name is Jeff Peterson. I'm the Executive Officer of Hearings and Release for the Department of Corrections for the state of Minnesota. I'd really like to take you briefly through the revocation process in regards to supervised release, kind of a 101 course, so that you have some perspective of how it takes place. And before I do that, I would just like to give you some updated figures. I know Mr. Carter gave you a lot of statistics, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. But just briefly, just to put the release violators in perspective, during fiscal year 2007, 7,482 offenders were admitted to prison. Of those admitted, 36% of those admitted were release violators. And we divide those release violators in two categories, and that is technical release violators, which were 32%, and those that returned on a new criminal offense but also had an old charge and offense under which they were under supervision. So you come up with 36%, which are not that much different than Mr. Carter's figures. Because release violators have shorter terms of stay in prison compared to those initially committed, at any given point in time, they account for a much smaller percentage. So, for example, on July 1st of 2007, there were 9,103 offenders incarcerated, of which 1,311, or 14%, were release violators at that spot in time, because they're transferred in and out much sooner. To answer your question, Mr. Stewart, that five-month period, yes, it does seem relatively short, but what you have to keep in mind that a high percentage of those for 5 months have reached sentence expiration. They only have that much time remaining on their total sentence, so thus they have to get out. Many of those also are higher risk offenders, such as our level threes, who housing plan has fell apart and can't be allowed to remain on the street until a residence can be approved. So both those figures make up a significant amount of those five-month returners. So it needs to be put in perspective.
One second, please.
Sure.
Mr. Davis?
The group we're talking about are people who have completed their sentence to serve and have been released. Is that right?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. You bet. Representative Eastland, could you restate your question so that I can get that to that right now?
Okay, my question was, if the supervising officer makes the recommendation that there's been a violation and they should go back to serve more of the sentence, how often does the Department of Corrections veto that recommendation, or do they?
Well, it's hard to put a figure or a percentage on that, but being the impartial authority to determine whether to revoke or not to revoke, we certainly take that recommendation into high consideration. But if the recommendation is not in line with what our revocation guidelines are, we will not follow it, and we don't follow it. So we certainly have the authority and the veto vote right there, and it's put into practice when we believe it's necessary.
Representative Eastman.
Is there some way we could get some kind of a number as to what that actually is? I mean, if you don't all the time, how often don't you? And because I mean, we keep hearing that there's less and less tolerance out at the supervising officers, and that's the reason that we're seeing lots of people come back into the system. And so, if their recommendation is the primary reason why they're coming back, and most of the time that is being that is just being gone along with by the department. I mean, we're still looking at 32% were technical violations, and I guess that's the issue that I'm kind of getting after is that seems like an awful high number. Now, they may be high risk, very high that need lots of supervision, have a tight rope on them, but I guess it would just be interesting to see those numbers.
Yeah, and again, we follow what we call revocation guidelines, and I was going to talk about that. So we have those guidelines in place, and we pretty much stick to them. in addition to some aggravating and mitigating factors that are also part of those. And so that's how we come up with what we do. We can take a look at that. We're doing 50, 60 hearings a week, so we would have to, you know, take a look at how many times it's not filed. It's something that we haven't done.
Okay. Please proceed, Mr.
Okay. You have a couple handouts, and I'm just going to go briefly through those now and not take up a lot of your time, because you have them before them, before you. You can read them, and there's two of them. And the reason there's two of them, in order to understand release violators, you also have to understand the release process, because they run hand-in-hand in conjunction with each other. And as you see on the first document, Minnesota DOC Supervised Release Process, I have indicated the authorities that our department and our commissioner operate under in regards to the setting of conditions of release, which are tied in with the revocations and the violations. So you see that under Chapter 243.05, the commissioner has been given by the state legislators and the legislature the authority to set conditions for release on offenders. That authority is then delegated to my office, the Office of Hearings and Release, and we do that. We set those conditions on offenders at the time they're released. So that's basically how that works. If you look at the reentry process actually begins when an offender becomes into prison. And there's things that are done that structure that offender's term in prison that will impact their release. They're assessed with a risk assessment. They're directed to treatment if mandated by law for CD and SO. And if they're a sex offender, they have initial screening for civil commitment. Those things are done right up front, and they follow that offender through prison and the impact the release process. 120 days prior to release, the actual release planning, the specifics of that release planning, is engaged. And the facility case manager in charge of a certain offender begins that process with the offender in discussing where you want to live, you know, in the state of Minnesota. And they come up with what looks to be a proposed valid residence, and that release assignment is then sent out to a local correction supervisor in the area of proposed residence, who assigns it to one of their agents, and that's investigated. That release placement is investigated to see if it's valid, if it's appropriate. In the case of a pedophile, whether or not there's minors living in the residence, which certainly wouldn't be approved. So situations like that. The agent recommends conditions, and together they return that package to the case manager, and the case manager and the agent come to some sort of conclusion on what release conditions should be applicable to this specific offender due to their offense. Their offense type, their criminal history, their social history, etc. There's also a set of general conditions on release that are promulgated in rule. And there's approximately 13 of those that every offender has that they get out. What I was talking about initially is special conditions that are applicable to certain offenders because of their criminal history. So the case manager and the agent work on those. Those come to us within 45 days of release, us being the Office of Hearings and Release. And then we evaluate and we review that plan for that specific offender, and we either approve or we defer that plan for changes, add conditions, take conditions away if they're duplications, and then that is merged into a release document that is discussed with the offender prior to release. And then it's not that they have to agree to it. If they don't sign it, they still go out with it. And the expectation is that they will comply with it. That becomes their governing document on their behavior at the time of release. We do approximately 1,500 of those reentry reviews a quarter, average about 25 to 30 a day. So it's a primary function that we play in the Office of Hearings and Release also. But that's how the release conditions are established, and that in brief is the release process. So you need to know that before we start talking about revocation, which is the second document. And there again, I outline the authorities that the Department of Correction and our commissioner received the our authority to for the revocation process under 244.05. And under that, the commissioner is to adopt by rule standards and procedures for revocation. Those standards of those rules and those standards were promulgated in Chapter 2940, and that's our governing document as far as the revocation process. So I refer you to that. Again, the revocation process and the revocation time is delegated from the commissioner to the Office of Hearings and Release and my respective hearing officers, according to Statute 243.05. I had mentioned revocation guidelines, and that is really an important document to the whole revocation process, because that those revocation guidelines address the commissioner's authority to set revocation under 244.05, and which also establish recommended presumptive penalties in accord with the promulgated rule. So we've taken that and we've established revocation guidelines, and we use that to determine what we're going to do in a specific case. Supervising agents have those guidelines set up severity levels of conditions in three different severity levels depending on the seriousness of the violation of a certain condition. Certainly a condition such as assault of threatening behavior is a higher severity than a failure to maintain contact with your agent or something like that. So they exist in different severity levels in coordination with the conditions that are being violated. Then there is a presumptive recommendation of revoke or restructure, revoke, and if revoke, for how long. So I have copies of those revocation guidelines for anyone that's interested if they want to take those with them. But they're a fairly thorough and complex document that we utilize. And it's usually incumbent upon the and this was a question, the supervising agent to be aware and to follow these guidelines whenever possible. A significant part of those guidelines are what we call aggravating and mitigating factors. You have the presumptive, but then you add to that, is there aggravating situations that should call for a longer period of time, or is there mitigating situations that should call for a shorter period of time? And so those elements are also used in the final disposition that we render as far as that violation. Again, in following that revocation process, it begins as a supervising agent will make a call to the Office of Hearings and Release to discuss a circumstance, a violation circumstance in regards to a particular offender they have under supervision. And then one of my hearing officers who's on that duty for that day in the office will do that and together. Many times, hopefully with the involvement of the agent supervisor, come up with an initial determination of which way to go. Is the violation of a serious enough nature that we need to issue a warrant, pull this offender off the street, get them in custody, and proceed to a revocation hearing? Or is it not an imminent risk for us that we can, by looking at the conditions of release and adding to or making more or accelerating the supervision or making it more intense, can we allow that offender to remain in the community without having to go through the revocation process, without having to be arrested, put into custody, et cetera? So that determination is made right up front.
Yes, sir. Peter, so what, in your view, what has changed in the last 10 or 15 years? The statistics that Mr. Karger presented are staggering. So have the guidelines changed, or has the philosophy changed relative to aggravating circumstances?
The fundamental element that we forget is that there's many, many, many more people out there. We have a much larger release population that we're working with,
mm-hmm.
and that has grown substantially from year to year.
Mr. Benson?
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that a couple of years ago, as we look at this, especially when we were under lots of pressure to find beds, and I think we determined that the percent of the whole over the course of time hasn't changed dramatically. I mean, there's a lot more people in the mix, but in terms of what percent of the release violators compared to the total population, I think those numbers, at least if my memory serves me correctly, have remained relatively constant. I mean, obviously the release violators have gone up, but the population has gone up. So I think what we need to do is examine what percent of the whole is it the same now as it was in 95, 2000, and understand how dramatically that has changed and if it's changed.
Well, I'm getting confused. Mr. Carger, can you speak to this? I mean, because if we're dealing with just, we have more offenders in the system, if that's what's causing the increase, then that's a whole different
right.
Scenario.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, but I think what I was showing was the admissions that were coming in, and there has been an increase in the admissions. And I think that, you know, you're looking at the whole, you know, the pie, you're comparing 1980 to the current situation, 2006, so you are showing an increase. And along with what Mr. Benson was saying, according to corrections, I think your probation revocations today make up 16% of the prison population. The supervised release returns are 14%. These are statistics I got from Mr. Storkamp, and I think what we need to look at, maybe corrections can give us this information, is what were those statistics in, say, 1980?
That's precisely my point, Mr. Chair. I can't speak to probation violations, but in terms of supervised release violators, I think that number has remained pretty consistent in terms of the number of people that we have in the mix.
Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, I'm wondering if, in your opinion, you think there are too many parole revocations occurring in Minnesota, and if that's the case, is it because counties are not adhering to the guidelines that have been developed by DOC in terms of aggravating, mitigating, and everything, or is it because the guidelines themselves need to be changed, especially as it relates to the technical violations that are going to prison?
Mr. Peterson,
I don't think it's a function of the guidelines that's producing them. That's my own opinion, because the guidelines haven't changed basically. So I think we talk about why the increase and there's factors, and we've talked about that. The one being the increase in the numbers out there. We have a lot of specialized caseloads too, that are 24/7 surveillance and whatever. We know in corrections, the closer that you supervise an individual, the sooner or the quicker you're going to catch that person doing wrong. Now, it's our responsibility in hearings and release to decipher where that wrong negative behavior lies in the scheme of revocation. You know, do we consider that as minor enough to remain in the community, or is it serious enough to get into the revocation process? And that's a determination that we hold. We consider over 1,500 violation circumstances of court in dealing with agents. And 45 to 50% of those end up going to a revocation hearing preceded by an arrest, putting into custody, and a hearing. That leaves another 50% that don't. And various things happened there. Either there was no violation in the first place after being investigated and checked out through more discussion with the agent, or they restructured and remain in the community with a graduated sanction or additional conditions or something like that. So when we talk about release violators, we got to look at the total picture. We got to look at those 1,500 violations that we consider, and only 45 to 50%, one half of those end up going to the revocation process. So once you get to that revocation hearing, it's reasonable to conclude that a high percentage of those are the more serious violators and thus will end up being revoked and going to prison, which is true. They do. you know, upwards to almost 90%.
A couple more questions, and then I think we better move on, otherwise sure. We're not going to get all of our presenters. And Mr. Davies, did you have a question?
Yeah, I had a question. To what extent are the revocations a substitute for a prosecution for a new crime?
Mr. Peterson.
They are not. We don't... there is a violation of new criminal behavior if in fact the county doesn't, decide to charge. Assault of behavior, for instance, can be charged under various things, as you know. There might be a decision because of witnesses, evidence, or whatever, not to charge. We do proceed then, because that we consider that criminal behavior. But if it's a new charge, that isn't a violation. If in fact they
county attorneys are in a position where they can say, well, we can get a there'll be a probation revocation, so we can get by without charging.
Yes, certainly that happens, and sometimes we have to process them without the criminal charge.
I've got one other really quick question. To what extent did the change with the guidelines independent guidelines? I can't remember how it happened. From the where the good time credit came after and first, did that make any difference to this
situation? Not a revocation. When we deal with supervised release and the revocation process, no.
We'll Representative Eastland, and then we'll go to Mr. Johnson, then we'll move on to our next presenter.
Thank you. There's just something it doesn't add up in my mind, and I guess maybe you can explain it. If the average revocation results in an additional 5 months, is that kind of what I heard?
Yes.
And we're working so hard to supervise these people, and any wrong that they do could land back in prison. And in 5 months, they're going to be walking around without a supervisor.
Right.
There's just something wrong with that picture. And I guess that's what I'm really struggling with here, is we're talking about all this intensive supervision on people that even if they go back, they're going to be out walking around with nobody watching them in 5 months. So I just don't understand what we're doing here. I mean, can somebody maybe shed some light on that to me?
Mr. Peterson? Or Mr. Commissioner, do you want to try it?
Mr. Chair, I can't shed any light, but I think the same thing happened with the short-term offenders. Mm-hmm. And that was our frustration with, you know, these people that have been on probation and they've been restructured, and then the judges finally say, to heck with it, and they violate the probation, send them to prison for their last 5 months, 3 months. Sometimes we got them in their release date was 2 days ago. So that happened with probationers as well. And I think it's just you reach the end of your rope where there's nothing left. They've been restructured 2, 3, 4 times. And finally they just say, you know what? We're not going to play with this guy anymore. We're sending him to prison for his last 3, 4 months, whatever it might be, of supervised release time. Then he's off paper. But running the risk of doing nothing and keeping him in the community is high stakes too, and I think that's essentially what was going on with the short-term offenders. You have a category of offender that they just don't do well under supervision, and the reality is a fair number of these people, they get off of paper and we never hear from them again, and that's the reality. But I agree with you, it doesn't make any sense, but it's not just the supervised release violators, it's those probation violators that the judges have reached the end of their rope. The court is sick of it, and they say, we know it doesn't make sense to send them to prison for 5 months or 4 months, but we've tried everything out here.
Ms. Johnson, we're not going to get all of our people, and so I'm just going to call on you, and then we'll move on, and then Judge Gomez and Mr. Carruthers will take you after we hear from the next presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just anecdotally, Jeff, I remember when I was a young agent, I seemed to feel like I had more discretion in when I might bring someone before the parole board at that time for a violation of their release. Do you think that these revocation guidelines have caused more attention to be spent to that particular process than to executing some some discretion with how you deal with an offender. Our agents may be thinking more along the lines of who's taking care of their conditions and who isn't, as opposed to what kind of services might an offender get that I could refer them to.
I think, Mr. Johnson, I think the phenomenon that you're talking about does exist, and I'm not sure it's an element of the guidelines, but it's an element in the environment of supervision that we live in today. With the last 10 years of lock 'em up philosophy and be very vigilant in how you supervise, that has been perpetuated, and we're still realizing some of that. We'd love the agent to exercise more discretion in working with their supervisor before they brought it to us, but they defer to us in the majority of situations, and we have to be the decision maker. Now, the decision maker in relation to that doesn't necessarily end up in the revocation process, and half the time ends up in a restructure. So, but there is some of that, and there probably isn't enough perceived discretion with agents and their supervisors, and a more willingness to say, let hearings and release deal with that, as opposed to, you know, this is our community. This is, we got local corrections here. We got community corrections here. Let us decide. I would, more of that needs to happen. If you could get back to that, certainly.
Mr. Chair.
Very quickly.
I think this is the reason that we in reentry are thinking about getting back to the use of a case plan, where caseworkers in our institutions work with the offender to develop a plan. I believe that a lot of the offenders that are released now are not really prepared for that release. And if we had a case plan in place, which is our intent with Yum Corp, and we use that case plan when the offender is released from the institution, I think we can change some of that culture back towards maybe trying to assist that offender to be successful when they're released, as opposed to watching over whether or not they're in violation of conditions.
Yeah, very good. Pardon me here, but I just want to move on. I want to make sure everyone gets an opportunity to speak with. We have the Public Defender's Office who we'll hear from as soon as Mr. Erickson and Mr. Weiber. Can you keep your comments for about 10 minutes? And then we'll...
Absolutely.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Weiber?
I
have a handout. Again, I'm the Deputy Director responsible for Adult Probation in Ramsey County. I've been doing the job 15 months, and... the data is good, but my understanding of the procedures may not be ideal. One of the things that I've noticed in a book that I spent a lot of time with, and Gary will be happy to hear this, is the report from the Reentry Policy Council, which has got great ideas for legislation and pilot projects and everything else, is that the revocation rate nationwide is over 60% in the first year. And so I thought it might be helpful to show what we're doing in Ramsey County. I have some additional stuff to add related to how that's changed since 2002, just to show you what we're doing with our offenders who are on supervised release. We're among the lowest states in the country in terms of incarceration. Well, our revocation rate is pretty low compared to other states as well. I know it can be better and everything else, but I want to at least provide that perspective. So if I could direct your attention to the pie chart, which is not on any of these things, but hopefully is in front of you. This is over about a 18-month period of time, January of 06 through September of 07. We had 1,207 supervised release offenders released into Ramsey County. Wow, that's pretty neat. I'm going to start coming here more often. But if I could draw your attention, so in other words, this pie reflects 1,207 supervised release offenders released into Ramsey County over an 18-month period. The yellow slice, which I've pulled out there, these are the individuals, 23%, who have been revoked and sent back to prison for one or more times. The green slice there, which is 38%,
These are folks that complete their supervised release with no revocations whatsoever. And then the blue slice is 38%. They're still open and they've had no revocations at all. So this is over an 18-month period of time. And I do have, unfortunately I'm going to do this verbally, for 2002, so how we've changed from 5 years ago. And I'm sorry that we sort of pulled this together about an hour and a half ago. So in 02, 68% of our offenders completed supervision without revocation. And combine that with those that were still open during 2002, that was another 3%. So the total was 71% that had no revocations at all, which is comparable to the 76% that we're currently experiencing. So we've not had much of a change at all over the last 5 years in terms of how many we're revoking and sending back to prison, and it's about a quarter of our population.
And Mr. Erickson, do the agents have enough, is their caseload sufficient, or is it to handle these offenders?
I'll do this quickly. We have six that do traditional supervised release. We have one that does sex offender supervised release, and then we have about 12 that do intensive supervised release, the ISR, more surveillance kind of work. The caseloads ideally, I think, would be in the 50 of these adults working with them. There are 75 to 90 is what they are now. Through the MCORP project, we're going to carve out two positions, and have them work at a caseload size of about 50, and then work with some of those additional resources of housing, get some training in case planning, motivational interviewing, COG skills, all that other kind of stuff. But the caseloads are enormous, 75 to 90. A lot of turnover in those positions for some reason. And there aren't the same amount of resources in terms of housing. It's just harder to find housing for these guys than occasionally women. That's basically, I just want to refer to the national numbers, our numbers, how we're doing and how it's changed. And that's my 3 minutes.
Very good. Thank you very much for keeping that brief. Mr. Weiber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't bring a pie chart, but if you'll take a look at Ramsey's again, the Ramsey's numbers, and just multiply them for anywhere from 2 to 2.5, those are Hennepin County's numbers. Because as far as caseload, violators, everything else, Ramsey is about 40% of Hennepin County's numbers. So, but the pie chart looks the same. And you just have larger numbers.
Same percentage being revoked?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that I would add in my last 30 seconds of speaking here is I hope that when we get into the session in 08, I know that you and Representative Eastland have talked about some kind of legislation here. Is what is it we can do through the legislative process to address these issues? I would like to speak to your committee, or have somebody from my county speak to your committee about a screening process that we have underway in the workhouse, where we are screening workhouse residents for EA eligibility. And over a 1 year period of time, we screened 276. We submitted applications on all 276, and 270 were approved. So these people were not on EA before they went in, but we screened them while they were in, and they were ready to go when they got out. The other thing that we've done is we've done a mental health screening project under a grant. We screened about 360 people. 180 have been referred for follow-up, and the other 180 have not. So we're doing a research project on that as to follow-up. You know, the whole issue on probation and supervised release revocation is not so much that they haven't completed anything, but maybe we haven't tapped into the right resources for these individuals.
Mr. Weiberg, is EA...
Economic Assistance, I'm sorry.
Very good, Norm.
Yes. At the Hennepin County Board, if you use an acronym, you have to throw a quarter in the fountain downstairs. So I'll throw a quarter outside when I leave. $25 Can I submit a grant for that? No. So these, I think these are the things that we need to look at, because, I mean, we're basically sitting here talking about numbers, and we're asking why. Why is this happening? You know, Representative Eastland said somebody goes back on a supervised release revocation, they serve 5 months in prison, and when they get out, we have no hook. We have nothing. They can do what they darn well please. They don't have to do any treatment. They don't have to do anything. We don't have a hook anymore. So if we take a look at doing a better job of starting the process in the institution, be it prison or be it county jail or county workhouse, with a seamless follow-up when they get out. I know we can affect these numbers.
Very good. Appreciate both your testimony. Mr. Chair,
if I can, one more comment. I know we've talked about probation violations and jail and prison, and we've also talked about parole revocations. To the extent that there's policy discussion, I mean, it's a very different process, and I think everybody knows that. One involves a judge, one does not, and so we ought not try to apply one policy change to try to fix both issues. So.
Very good, thank you. I'm going to ask the Public Defender's Office to come up now before I have several people that want to ask questions or have comments to make, but I want to make sure we get all the presentations up correct. So I believe Mr. Sandvik, Mr. Gallo, Mr. Peterson, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and tell us what you want to tell us. We appreciate you coming this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Office of the State Public Defender's Office. Up to my right is Eric Sandvik, who is an attorney with the 2nd Judicial District, and to my left is Rick Gallo, who is an attorney with the Appellate Office. The three of us, primarily the two of them, actually will address the from the public defense perspective the issues it's been talking about today. We represent the offenders in both the probation revocation hearings and the supervised release hearings. One of the gentlemen will be talking about each.
Thank you. Go ahead. Please proceed. Yeah.
The only other thing I would like to say is we have the handout that is circulating around the room shows the numbers of violations that our respective offices have been experiencing over time. By the way, I assume everyone maybe knows this, but in very brief form, the difference, we're talking about two different things, as was just mentioned. We're talking about probation violations, which occur to people who have been sentenced, but their sentence was stayed and they have not yet gone to prison and they're under supervision to a judge, as opposed to supervised release violations, which is a situation for an offender who has been in prison, has been released from prison, is now under the supervision of a supervised release agent. And they're really two very different things in a lot of ways. So the figures, just to get by those quickly, and then I'll turn it over to these other two gentlemen here, that I've had on the first page behind the cover sheet there, you'll see numbers for the adult probation violations over time there. You said they're quite self-explanatory, but as you can see, they go up rather markedly from just below 4 to 07. Flipping the page, the numbers relate to the supervised release hearings that are handled by the appellate office. Again, from over time, these are the hearings that our office handles, so these are just to give you an idea of the number of hearings. They have nothing to do with time served or results of hearings, just to show you the volume of the hearings. And the last page does the same thing over a slightly longer period of time. I know we don't have much time to talk. The way we're going to approach this today, Mr. Sandvik is going to talk about probation revocations first, because that is the first step in the process of these two types of hearings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here this afternoon. My name is Eric Sandvik, and I'm a 2nd Judicial District Public Defender. I work in Ramsey County right now as an assistant public defender. Part of my caseload in my current position is to handle probation violations. And a person, as you said, can be put on probation for any number of things, from a case as minor as a DWI or an obstruction of legal process to something as serious as a felony level offense. My job is to handle probation violations. I'm in court approximately every other week handling probation violations. And my comments, they reflect my experiences sort of in the trenches. In addition to working in the 2nd Judicial District, I was a law clerk starting in 2003 up in the 10th Judicial District, and worked out of the Cambridge Public Defender's Office up in Mr. Eastland's district. To start off with the probation violation, is a hearing where the state has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that my client or defendant has violated probation. It's a much lesser standard than our client faced in their original criminal charges. Violations can be for a wide variety of things, and the two areas that I'd like to talk about this afternoon are the new conditions that our clients face, which are kind of separate from the second area, which is technical violations. And that's something that that I've seen and my colleagues have seen a lot more of in the past 3 years that I've been a public defender. Technical violations are characterized by missing a couple of appointments with probation, not staying in contact with their probation officer, failing one urine analysis test. A lot of other violations that I see are people that are charged with a new offense and they get a probation violation right away when that new offense hasn't really been vetted out. They're charged with a new offense. Who knows what happens to them? Many charges, get dismissed because of bad traffic stop or bad search issues or other things. We've seen a lot of violations for people that are, charged with something and haven't been found guilty or proven guilty of that yet. These violations underline a lot of the same issues that lead our clients to our offices in the first place. Chemical dependency issues and poverty. So many of our cases deal with chemical dependency issues and treatment is not always available to our clients. We talked about poverty and our clients are in that transient population zone. They don't have stable housing or stable mailing addresses and it is difficult for them to stay sometimes in contact with probation. Many of them don't have telephones, their phones are disconnected, they have cell phones with no minutes on them. It's difficult for me to get in contact with them. I'm sure it's also difficult for the probation officer to get in contact with them. Well, some of my experiences working in outstate Minnesota, probation likes to have a lot of meetings and certainly at the beginning with clients. Most of my clients, or a big percentage of them, don't have a driver's license and don't have a car. Their probation officer in some of the rural counties can be 50 miles away from where they live, and there's a lot of difficulty that my clients express to me about maintaining that contact when you don't have a car and don't have a good phone line to stay in contact. I think the numbers that were put forth showed that our probation violations over the last 4 years increased approximately 25%. Even in the 3 years that I've been a public defender, I've seen probation violations increase throughout my time, but not both in the rural counties where I work up in Cambridge and also in the urban areas that I work here in the 2nd District. I think just to kind of close, I'd like to give a little bit of an example. Mr. Krieger was in court with me last week of a violation that is something very typical that I've seen. I was assigned to a client calling Mr. Harris, who was a probation violation. He was sentenced on a felony sentence on a robbery charge to a 46-month state sentence. He has a long history of mental health problems, had been involved with a number of different attempts to get himself through those difficulties. He did have a criminal record. Some of the things in his past were drinking in public and some fairly minor charges. The court originally sentenced him to 365 days up front. He, after being at the workhouse and being released out on a work program, walked away for a few days. He tells me he wasn't getting his medication. He was at a real low point dealing with some schizophrenia issues and other issues. Came back to the workhouse a few days later and was violated for that. He came before the court where I represented him. Probation and the county attorney both were asking for execution of his sentence at that very first violation. Thankfully, the case was continued for some technical reasons, and we were able to convince the court not to violate Mr. Harris's probation and allow him to serve some additional jail time. But I think that case really illustrates a lot of what my colleagues and I are facing doing this type of work out in the trenches. We've seen a lot of technical-type violations like Mr. Harris had, where probation and the county attorneys are asking for execution right off the bat, not allowing our clients a chance to have that rehabilitation part of probation. I guess that's my comments, and I think I certainly do want to ask questions, or I don't know if we want to go to the next speaker and then ask questions if you want.
Yeah, why don't you think about this question as we go to the next speaker, as what recommendation would you have for this working group? And why don't we take your testimony now?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carter, thank you for asking me here. And I want to say hello to those of you that I know, Mr. Benson, especially I haven't seen you for a while, and Professor Davey. It is a great pleasure to see you today. My name is Frank Richard Gallo, Jr., Rick Gallo. I've worked in the State Public Defender's Office since 1985. When Mr. Stewart came in as our Chief Public Defender, we had some reorganization, and the Morrissey hearings, which you are calling parole hearings, supervised release hearings, revocation hearings, Morrissey hearings, were given to my division. And so I've been doing them since then. To give you a little bit more background on these, in 1996, when the legislature created community notification, I was assigned to that as well. So I have been the main attorney that's been involved with predatory offender registration and the community notification issues in our office, mostly the appeal for those to review, but in every way that those can be affected since then. So of course, I tell you that because that gives me a different slant as well. We were crunching the numbers today, trying to come up with some specifics for you, and I was surprised to see how many Morrissey hearings I've actually done over the last 20 years. And I remember when Mr. Peterson took over the division, and this was around 1995, 96, 97, 10 years ago. And that's the important figure. The important figure of what you've heard is that in the last 10 years, there's been a change. And I'm not blaming Mr. Peterson for that. I don't think that that all comes down to him, but we certainly have seen a philosophical change occur in Minnesota, and as Mr. Benson knows as well, over the course of at least since I started in 85. I wanted to start out by telling you there is a lot of mental illness and a lot of chemical dependency, and specifically from the Department of Corrections on how much that's involved in crime, I think are significant to what you're really looking at. I have had some differences with some of the testimony that's been presented today. I'm not going to go there. I created a little outline for myself and some suggestions from my perspective as to things that maybe you can look at. But overall, and I've been saying this all day, and I hope this wasn't inappropriate, you guys are trying to come up with a bandage. This is really a societal problem that causes people to be in prison to begin with. When you look at the files of these offenders, you see the problems are symptomatic of what's taking place in society. And until we go there with the resources, until we go there with taking care of our children and having them being raised with responsibility and respect, we're going to continue on with these numbers. And this is what I think we've been seeing over time. Seeing greater and greater amount of crimes, greater and greater amount of people who refuse to take responsibility. It's just been a problem that continues to grow. And here we are trying to fix the end of it. What do you do when they come out of prison? I'm going to go quickly through the general part of my outline, and I have more subdivisions, so if you ask questions, I can get that.
You could just keep it to a few minutes, though, because we have a lot of questions and comments here, and I apologize, we have a short amount of time.
I understand. Post-prison return. I see this as a result of minor violations of supervised release results in return. I've seen people return to prison for use of a marijuana cigarette the first time they've been out of prison for violation. Offenders return to prison for treatment. Treatment may still be available in the community of the person, but the person is put in prison. DOC treatment programs are long-term now. They require thus longer placement. You have the next, again, I have to skip to the bigger point. You have policies to the danger to the community, and I want to mention these four things. There's no way to predict who's dangerous to the community, as we found out in the Rodriguez case. And yet, people get the cameras placed in their face. As a result, they don't want to make decisions to release people. It's safer to return them to prison because you can't differentiate. Persons are being labeled as sexual predators under our laws, even though there's not even an allegation of a sex crime now that causes you to be a registering predatory offender. You hear it in the news, you hear it from even legislators who talk about sex offender. Predatory sex offenders, level 3 sex offenders. If you have a false imprisonment allegation, keep your boyfriend from going out the door, and you'll be registering as a level 3 predatory offender if you have the right history. You're scaring people with these kinds of terms and with these kinds of laws. Community notification itself, 244052, limits the releasee's ability to have placement or employment in society. You take a guy coming out of prison, he can't get a job or a place to live, where's he going to end up? Back in prison. Not to mention that before that happens, you spend a lot of money with supervising relief agents who are working their butts off trying to find a person a place to live or a job. Fourth point under the politics of danger to community. Is there a blanket relief condition that applies to certain types of offenders? If you have a sex offense, then that's going to allow you access to a computer, the internet, possibly not a cell phone. How can you possibly, in this society, make it out there without access to a computer, internet, or cell phone? And this isn't necessarily tied to the person's particular offense. The next bigger point I have, offenders are returned to prison when they should not be. First point is, people are placed in prison for lack of community resources. If you can't find a place where the person lives, you hold them in prison. Offenders are revolts who have no relief plan. People come out, if they don't have a place to go, they're held in jail to have a hearing. Where do you put them? Back in prison. Prisons are used now as a substitute for the security hostel. If you have someone who has a dual commitment, DHS and DOC, and if they are considered to be in violation while they're in DHS, they get returned to prison. Now, this isn't for 5.5 months. This can be for 10 years, the end of their conditional release period. Oh, except that the legislature in 2005 now has lifetime conditional release. So, if you have a dual commitment person, they offend or they violate some condition at DHS where it costs $400 a day, let's send them to the DOP where it costs $100 a day for the rest of their life. I want to give you an example for that one. This is a case that I was recently working on. Mr. Peterson may actually recognize this. The case of the guy, the initials are FN. He was dual commit at the DHS. Committed as a sexual psychopath. His offense was on a teenage girl's friend of his daughter. While he was in prison, before he was released from prison, he was allowed to have contact with his son. His son was a minor, his son would come to visit him at prison. He gets out on release, DHS, and they said no contact with minors. So he continues to have phone conversations with his son about schooling, sends him a Christmas card. He ends up in a revocation hearing and is revoked back to prison for contact with minors. That stuff is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. That is a true case. The additional bigger point, the next bigger point, offenders are being placed in prison when they're not revoked. There's currently a case, the initials of the guy are J.R. On June 13, 2006, he was found in violation for job hunting without approval. But the hearing officer determined not to revoke him back to prison, determined to restructure him for the community. However, he didn't have a residence. So they said, we'll hold you back at Lionel Lake for the next 30 days until you can find a residence. That was June of 06. As of today, he's still in prison. I can give you case after case after case where people have been sent to prison for 90 days or 150 days, and it took 2 or 3 years before they were released because they didn't have anywhere to go. That should not happen. The last bigger point is the short-term offender statute. Now, short-term offenders to me are people who have felonies but are kept in the local jail, county jail. Short-term offender statute is a short-term fix that backfires. I believe it was a good tool given to the Department of Corrections to help reduce their numbers. But what happened was you built the county jail. And when you built the county jail, the county jails ended up having to transport people back and forth from jail to jail, whatever had to take, even across the border into Wisconsin jail or Iowa jail. And when we would come up on supervised release hearings, one of the tools previously used was you have somebody who had a violation, didn't want to really return to prison, maybe a little short of stay in the jail would have done 30, 60 days. No longer could you keep the person in the jail. You couldn't keep them long. You couldn't keep them there to maybe help maintain your employment or anything. A tool was removed. Again, those are bigger points, but I certainly think if more detail if you have questions. My suggestions quickly, and again, they are from my particular plan. I said repeal the short-term offender statute. John Stewart and I had a discussion about this a while ago, and I have a different viewpoint on short-term offenders. Repeal that statute. Make available shorter Department of Corrections treatment programs. I think the Department of Corrections with funding has ended up having to have long-term treatment programs. Previously, we had shorter treatment. I don't remember if we had a 30-day program, but I'm pretty sure we have 60-day counsel dependency programs, 90 days. Those don't exist anymore. Better use of community-based treatment programs. Now, even if the treatment program is available in the community, we send them back to the DOC. Fund short-term, 30 to 90-day community residential placement for certain types of offenders. We're going to leave the notification statute alone. Those, I think, are the best people to identify. They're the ones that are harder to place for agents all around the state. A little easier in the metro area, but all around the state, you have huge difficulties with placement. Reduce the offender's release costs. This is huge. You have someone coming out of prison, they have nothing, absolutely nothing. They got $100 at the door minus whatever fee they had to pay. Now you expect them to pay their supervision costs. If it's a sex offender, you expect them to pay their treatment costs, thousands a year. You expect them to pay for willy-nilly polygraphs that are requested, and that's $407 polygraph. This changed in the statute 2005. You put those kinds of costs on someone who's trying to find a place to live and trying to work at McDonald's, there is no way they're going to make it to the community. They're coming back to prison. I know the statute says that it's, in essence, a sliding scale, but that's not what's happened. The commissioner is supposed to, I think, come up with a scale on ability to pay. That is not what has happened. Better tailor the release conditions to the conviction history. You have offenders, I'll give you one example, 19-year-olds who maybe have 15-year-old girlfriend, sanctioned by the family, gets the girl pregnant. Well, that's a sex offense. It's just. And now, you know, the girl grew up and they had gotten together and they now have a couple of kids. And he commits another offense, goes to prison. When he comes out of prison, even though he has a family, he will not be able to live with his own children. That's ridiculous. If you think about it, that's simply ridiculous. We throw all of the sex offenders in a big bushel and we say, you're a sex offender, you don't get to do this. There has to be some better discretion involved in this. Now, I see Mr. Nasty over here, an agent, and really what's happened over the last 2 years is some of the laws that have been put into place are tying the hands of the agent to be able to use the discretion on the case. I'd like to see the agents have more discretion. Now, of course, there are good agents and bad agents, and that's up to Mr. Peterson and his folks at HRU, Hearing Release Unit, to take a look at it in hearing. But in the overall, let the agents who know the specific case tailor better those release conditions instead of having the blanket rules. Quit using prison as a default for residential placement. Have better use of programs. Hey, two more questions.
Okay.
Better use of programs that allow early release upon completion of the program. We have ICS. It's in the statute, not used. Work release is used.
ICS.
Intensive community supervision. And I'm sorry I did not bring the statute number with me. It's right in there. Still exists, but for the CIC, the boot camp statute. And then you can do some modifications on the, you can better tailor the registration statute, 243166. 2 points with that. Give the discretion to the district court judge to determine the nexus between the enumerated predatory charge and the conviction. Right now, it's left to the Department of Corrections to have to get the nexus. And the default is to assume everyone is a predatory offender. There are plenty of judges who don't want that nexus. There's no probable cause for the charge, for example. With that, let me say one last thing. That's to answer Representative Eastland's question. You wanted to know, Representative Eastland, and I raised my hand. If I heard your question correctly, you wanted to know how often the decision to revoke is reversed at the Department of Corrections. Is that your question? Mr. Peterson is the appellate authority on every single revocation hearing. So if there's an offender who's been revoked and we challenge that, we write to Mr. Peterson. And I would be surprised if Mr. Peterson can tell you that in the last 10 years, he has overturned 10 decisions by any of his hearing officers. So there's your answer. 1 year, maybe. But Mr. Peterson would know that, and he's still here, so he could answer this more specifically. And with that, I thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, all three of you. I'd appreciate if you could make your recommendations were clear, and if you could get those in writing to Ms. Lacombe, and any other recommendations that you have. I'm hoping that this working group is going to meet one more time before the legislative session starts sometime in, we'll meet in January, and see if we can call this out and come up with something that's practical. But I'd like to, well, there's four people who have signed up to make comments or testify. Why don't you just stay there? And Ms. Gomez, I cut you off first. Did you still have a question or comment, or do you want to pass?
I have a comment, but I'd like all of our guests or the invited people.
Everyone has testified, so we're ready now. And Mr. Carter is going to have the last word because he's going to talk about what other states are doing, but I want to make sure the working group has a chance to talk. Do you have a comment or a question?
Well, I do, and I think the court has gotten off easy here today.
Can you pull up that mic a little bit closer to you?
Okay. Yeah, is that better?
Yeah.
I think the court has gotten off easy here today because we've been focused so much on supervised release revocations. And I want to make a broad statement about a shift that I think would be very important for us to discipline ourselves to make. And that is a shift from using the word and concept rehabilitation to reducing recidivism. And here's why I say it. Because I have said, hoping that somebody would call me on it and make me explain, that rehabilitation is a bankrupt concept. And what I mean by that is a lot of the situation we're in because we don't think very straight about our helping efforts. I bet there aren't any judges who take that job who don't want to help people. And that's all fine and good. But here's what happens when a judge, me, is doing that helping in a framework of rehabilitation as opposed to reducing recidivism. I think about changes in my practice that I made because I had the opportunity to take some of my time as a judge away from those overwhelming caseloads and go to the Guidelines Commission, and I began to learn some things about evidence-based practice, etc. This is typical of what I did. It's typical of what everybody does, and I wouldn't be confessing if it were so rare. I think about a kid who did an armed robbery, and he's 19, and the guidelines say he should go to prison, and we don't want to send a 19-year-old to prison. Nobody does. So the county attorney and the defense attorney and I agree on how to handle the kid, and we put him on probation, which is, I think, fine. So far, so good. I look at the kid. He's valuable. I see him as valuable as my kid. That's good, too. I want him to have a good life and to be a good person, and in that sense, I'm focused on rehabilitation. So I order all the things, I order him to do the things that I know my kids had to do to grow up as functional adults. And of course, as is completely predictable, there are a lot of those things for the kinds of reasons that you've heard here today and a whole lot of other reasons. He's not particularly good at doing, so it is true. He will not contact his probation officer, and then he'll come back to court, and then we tune him up, and he does a few days, and we put him out, and then he has a dirty UA, because although there's absolutely no connection between his smoking weed, which he should not be doing, my kids certainly were not okay with me, despite the fact that there's no particular connection between his smoking weed and robbing people, we have said that he can't smoke weed. And so it's absolutely predictable, since the kids that we're talking about have the kind of lives where they assuage their pain with weed, because they've told me that. I've had kids say, I can't stand my life, and that's why I smoke, Judge. So, okay, so then we get a dirty UA, and we bring him in, because we don't want to do that. And then, after a while, we send him to treatment, because he's still smoking weed. And in treatment, because he is not my kid, and he was not raised, you know, is not particularly well socialized, he ticks off everybody in the program, and they kick him out. And by this time, I've seen him 3 times. And then I put the kid, this actually happened, all of the above, and I put the kid in a halfway house, one of Dan Kane's, actually, and he is not getting along very well there. He doesn't want to do his chores. He has a different job every day, blah, blah, blah. So then he comes in, and I send him to prison. What is wrong with that picture? If I was aimed at rehabilitation, then I might as well send him to prison, because he's clearly not being rehabilitated. But if I were using evidence-based practices to focus on programming that might help him, which might be the same programming, and he came in, and I'm still disappointed with him, he is not robbing anybody. He has not committed a single crime. If I'm focused on recidivism, I am not sending him to prison. And when I say we need to be looking at recidivism, that is because there is a lot of research about programming that helps people become more functional so they don't commit crimes. And the whole system is about protecting public safety. It is about preventing crime. It is not about me shaping and molding people to look like my kids. And
thank you. Mr. Brothers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief comment, and this actually hooks into something the judge said. On Mr. Sandvig gave the example of the robbery and the 48-month state sentence. Just to reiterate what the judge just said, is that that's a presumptive commit. So, you know, he normally would have gone to prison, but instead it was stayed. And so, you know, you have to put the probation violation in that context, okay? That, and, you know, I frankly, I don't see many cases where somebody gets their probation revoked on one offense, unless it's a pretty serious offense. I don't see that often at all. But, I mean, I'm not saying it never happens, but that's just something you got to keep in mind, that, you know, normally under sentencing guidelines, if the judge was following sentencing guidelines and didn't stay execution, that person would have gone to prison, but they were given another chance, and usually multiple chances, and then at some point, as the judge said, then it gets revoked. But let me just say, too, as a prosecutor, that, you know, I totally agree with the need for services, and I really like the point that you made, Mr. Gallo, about short-term services, because, you know, when the person gets who's a supervised release violator and gets sent back to prison for, you know, 5 months or something like that, you know, I'd really like to see them get some program, because, you know, I've never figured out, but the percentage of cases that come into the county attorney's office that are chemical dependency involved is a, you know, shockingly high percentage. And, you know, if we could deal with the underlying mental health, chemical dependency issues, as Andy Erickson said, or maybe it's somebody else, but educational opportunities in prison or, you know, outside of prison, I think it would be a lot better, because, you know, we don't want to send them back to prison either. We'd much rather have them be contributing members of society. So, you know, to the extent that that this committee and the legislature can make some of those programs available, I think everybody would be better off.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
I forgot what my question was going to be.
Okay.
Well, I've heard some great things here, so I'm thinking about some of the things I've heard.
Commissioner Benson, you were next.
Mr. Chair, members, a couple of things. I certainly agree with Mr. Gallo's points around chemical dependency and mental health. We've talked about that at previous meetings. I don't think there's any question that we have an epidemic with respect to mental health issues with our prison population today. And chemical dependency, we talked about the 80% that are at least abusing chemicals, if not chemically dependent. So certainly we recognize that. As we discussed briefly yesterday, short-term chemical dependency treatment for our population, the results just aren't there. So we have gone more to long-term treatment. I believe that if we could hook shorter-term treatment with aftercare, that aftercare component is really what's important. Good inpatient, but aftercare in the sober houses that we read about in the news last year are absolutely a must if people are going to succeed after investing time and money in primary treatment. So we have to somehow come to terms with the fact that the sober house environment is critical. It teaches people how to live sober. Primary treatment is very, very different. Again, any addict can stay straight in a 30-day primary treatment, but to learning to live your life sober is very different. The other point I wanted to make is consistent with the point I tried to make earlier, and I think I said that the number of release violations or hearings is about the same as it was consistent with the whole 10 years ago. And if you look at your chart, that bears that out. Our prison population has doubled since I came to central office in 1996, 11-year period. I'd also again state that I don't think we've had another decade since the Great Depression where a prison population has doubled in an 11-year period. And the hearings have doubled. If you look at this chart from 1995, it was 1,500. In 2007, which is actually 12 years, it's 3,300. That's about double. I'm guessing that 1996, the number of hearings was probably 1,600, maybe 1,650, and now it's 3,305. So I don't think we're out of whack in terms of the whole. It's about the same. So, I mean, it seems much larger because obviously it's doubled, and I don't think you have twice the attorneys. We don't have twice the hearing officers. Everybody's workload has increased. But in terms of percent of the whole, it's about the same. And just the last point I want to make, and I'm not going to speak for Representative Eastland, but the question I heard Representative Eastland ask is, when the agents come in and recommend one thing, how many times does hearings and release disagree? Not how many times does hearings and release overrule on appeal. I would say that the 10 is probably pretty consistent. When I was a warden for 5 years and the offender would appeal due process sanctions, probably 2-3 a year, not very many. And you get to know each other pretty darn well during that process. So I would say I'm not ashamed if it's only 10. I think that's a good number. I think that means that hearings and release and agents have a pretty good understanding of what to expect. So I just wanted to make that clarification. Again, I think I would challenge repealing the short-term statute. I think there's a better way to manage that. I think regional jails or prison is not the place to bring people who are going to serve 3 or 4 months. It just isn't. We cannot be all things to all people. We can't manage people who are going to serve 30 years in prison and people who are going to serve 5 months. A 5-month sentence is a local sanction. And it's too bad if our counties don't have the wherewithal to provide 5 months training. And I understand they don't. And we're dealing with a committee of people who are looking at this short-term issue And I really think I think there's a better answer than either at the local level or the state level. I think we have to take a hard look at regional jails for the short-term offenders and better transition back into the community. We can use them both ways, bringing them in, the short-termers, and bringing them out of prison for the longer-term offenders. And I really agree with what you said, Mr. Gallo, on prevention. You're absolutely right. All of us that read these files every day, we're not making excuses for the people that end up in prison, but we certainly can't explain why they ended up in prison. They are raised by the wolves, as my friend Isabel would say, and they don't have a chance in life. They absolutely don't. It's very understandable how and why they end up with us. And if we can ever get beyond trying to fix this thing overnight and start to invest some money into early childhood success by six, parenting, it's a 20-year result, but it's so much more cost-effective than trying to pound the dents out of a Cadillac that's been rolled seven times. It's never going to drive the same. And some of these people who are raised in these neighborhoods by the street are never going to be the same. And I don't say we quit trying. It's like preventing cancer or treating cancer. Where can we be more effective in the long run?
Okay. Mr. Sandvik, Mr. Gallo, Mr. Peterson, thank you for your testimony. Sorry for the time. But I really would appreciate if you put your recommendations in writing. I know Representative Eastland and I are serious about pursuing some legislation next year, whether all this would get in there or not, but we need to. It may be just, Commissioner, maybe all we can do is knock the dents out of the Cadillac right now until we can deal with the broader societal problems. We'll keep knocking. I'd like Mr. Carter now to talk a little bit about what is going on in some other states, and maybe we can learn from that or think about some of those possibilities here in Minnesota.
This is just an observation. I was just looking at the numbers here, and I don't know what it says, but the prison population from 1990 to current, I think we said we increased 179% or something like that.
1990,
something like that. And then, but then if we look at this thing that we just got here, the Public Defense Appellate Office supervised release hearings. They've increased 500% over the same period of time. I mean, I don't know what that means, but it means something.
You need more public defenders.
So something is happening on the supervised release side that's happening much faster than what's happening on the prison growth side. So, I mean, I'm not sure what that means, but it's just an interesting observation that I think is telling of something going on.
Mr. Carter, do you want to respond to that, or do you want to just proceed with the...
Well, I think those numbers are correct, what Representative Eastland had. I think that you showed that the public defender said it's about a 500% increase, where the prison population went up 179% during that time period.
Okay, very good. Do you want to proceed?
Okay, we are just going through what some of the other states are doing and what some of the experts are recommending in this area. First one is Horn. He was the probation director, I think, or corrections director in Pennsylvania and also New York, head of their probation. He had a radical proposal. We're going to start out with that one. Completely eliminate parole supervision. Replace it with a personal responsibility model. You go to a prison, you go to a halfway house, you have an agreement that you're not going to commit any crimes, and you have vouchers that you're going to use to purchase treatment services and other services needed. Probably never fly in this state, but that's the first one. Second one, which has been mentioned here many times, I think, during today's session, revocation centers. We talked to Montana. I called a couple people in Montana. They have a couple revocation centers, 60 days. They said, you know, why send these people for 4, 5, 6, 7 months to prison when you can have a revocation center that, first of all, is going to be cheaper than or less expensive than corrections, and you're going to save corrections beds by not having them in the prison for 5 or 6 months when you can
have them in a revocation center for 30 or maybe 60 days. Also, they provide some treatment in that revocation center. Locally, you know, there's local revocation centers. They also have some regional jails, also in Montana. Very progressive state. Washington State, they have, now I haven't followed this up with the state of Washington, but in the reading, it looks like they're returning, or parole violators that are coming from prison, they have passed legislation that says they should only do 30 or 60 days. But the bad part of that, Ron, is that they're at the local jail. So, but I mean, that's another option there. Some of the people are saying reinvent supervision. They're saying, I don't know if this is happening in Minnesota. Their rearrest rates are the highest in the months following release from prison. So you put all your resources, or most of your resources, in during those first couple months. For example, from the study that the Bureau of Justice statistics, within 6 months, 30% of people are rearrested. Within 1 year, 44%. And remember, within 3 years, it's 67%. Also, we just read a study, I think it was in the New England Medical Journal, that people that are released from parole, they're 12 times more likely to die within the first couple weeks than the average person. Drugs, homicide, and there was one other. Reentry courts, as Mr. Stewart said,
yes.
I think there's 12 going on right now in the United States. Their evaluations are being done on them. I think the jury is still out on how effective they are. Michigan, too, created technical violation centers in lieu of reincarceration. Risk assessment. Some people are saying that there are tools out there for risk assessment. Maybe this should determine, I know some counties are using this, on how much time or what resources should go into those that really need the resources and how much time these people should be on probation. Also, the National Institute of Corrections, they have helped 29 jurisdictions develop policies relating to how the state should respond to violations. I don't think Minnesota was one of them, but they're out there to consult. The other thing is, a lot of people are saying develop a range of alternatives. Remember, I went to a conference where Jim Austin, who is an expert in the prison area, spoke, and this was years ago, and he said, don't put these people in prison for the first couple of violations. You need graduated sanctions. Sure, there has to be some penalty, but you step it up. Intermediate sanctions, the last step would be prison. And that's some of the items that we found out. There's more, and we can summarize those. I know you're short on time, maybe on a little memo to the committee.
Let's do it.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to take a second to get an idea on the idea list. It seems to me there might be room to expand the people who would be eligible for early release after serving 50% of their guideline sentence instead of two-thirds. And that perhaps could be expanded to some broader categories of offenders. I mention this because I think it would have two benefits. First of all, it would create incentives for the offender from the beginning to work on a case plan for succeeding in prison and getting out. And secondly, then there would be more than 5 months hanging over their head once they're released. As Mr. Weiborg said, there's no hook anymore, because the person serves so much time before they get out. And if they had a chance to get out earlier by carrying out a thought-through case plan, that would have that benefit as well.
Are you suggesting all offenders? Are you suggesting a category of offenders?
Mr. Chair, I think it could be expanded from what it is now. I recognize that there are violent offenders that are in there for purposes of incapacitation, where the will isn't there, and it might not be good for us to be planning for them to get out. but people that are in there for property and drug offenses, for instance, people that have offenses relating to stolen goods, lake cabin burglaries, cars, a lot of those people, there's no magic. If you sentence somebody to 48 months, there's no magic to say, well, you can apply to get out at 32 months because that's two-thirds. You could set up a system where a lot more people could apply to get out at 24 months having completed a case plan.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. David.
John Stewart and I have not talked to each other about this. I just want everybody to understand that. My thought came off Dennis Benson's comments that so many of the offenses arise out of mental illness and out of chemical dependency. And in both of those instances, Dennis suggested you have the inpatient chemical dependency treatment, and then what you want is not for them to go back into the general prison population, but rather to go into a halfway house, which is the natural follow-up. It seems to me we have to set up a system where there's no reason for the corrections department to hold off giving chemical dependency until the last 30 days they're going to be in, but rather there is should be a desire to give that treatment at, when the person's right for it, let them finish that treatment, and then let them go into a halfway house. That we have to give the corrections department that kind of flexibility.
Right. Gary, did you want to say?
Yeah, I just forgot two of them. And one of them was that maybe more halfway houses are needed. I think Travis said that in his book. The other one that I forgot to mention is there are few incentives for success, something like what you're talking about there for the prison population. Parolees are readily sanctioned for negative behavior but seldom rewarded for positive behavior.
Yeah.
Early release from parole is underused. Nevada, they get a month off their parole term for every successful month on parole. Also, Georgia, the state, has a reward system. They said that rewards, I don't know, Mr. Johnson, you might comment on this, but the rewards supposedly work very well with these offenders like they do. They work supposedly in drug court very well.
I'll agree with you there, Gary. The reentry best practices is that you should focus on the positive side of someone's behavior as opposed to the reinforcing the fact that someone's going to get revoked if they conduct themselves negatively. So that's true. Another thing I want to say about treatment is that reentry best practices says that you focus that treatment in the community, not necessarily in the institutions. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have additional treatment programs in the institutions. I think they're needed. But if you're going to really do good treatment programming with people, it needs to be out in the community where they're going to live. And you need to do it, as Gary said, at an early stage in their release, because that is the point at which they are probably going to make a decision to either go positively in their life or negatively in their life.
Kind of radical notion, I guess, because I'm not, and because I'm not an economist, I can't even lay it out very clearly. When I listen to the various discussions about what we ought to be doing and the discussions in this committee, a thing that's overwhelming, whether we're talking about sex offenders or talking about reentry, whatever, is how money is an issue. So we hear 70% of sex offenders leaving prison don't have housing. We're releasing people to under bridges. 15% of the sex offenders in prison get treatment, all that stuff. I would like us, just as a matter of clarification, I'd like to see if it would be possible for us to take all of the sums that we are spending on this population of serious offenders, or felons, if you want to, just all of the various pots of money, in the commitment program, in the wherever it is. Total that up, and then think about knowing what we would like to do. You know, what our goals would, what goals we want, how we would ideally deal with that population. Just kind of divvy up that pot, just schematically, just to look at it. To see, for example, what would happen if you shifted of that 59 million or whatever it is that we're using on commitment, second only to California, if we took that 11 million that the commissioners said we needed to do sex offender treatment in prison to those that DOC wants to treat, that kind of thing. I mean, it would just be a clarifying exercise, I think, for us to really come to grips with how much money we've got and think about if we wanted to redistribute it, then how, you know, what kinds of statutory structures or whatever we need to build. That's
thank you. Any other closing comments or questions? Mr. Weiber.
Yeah, just one. A second one, Isabel just said. We need to take a look at reallocation of financial resources, because my caution as a, I guess, not speaking for every county in Minnesota, but if we're going to do seamless services, if we're going to start treatment in the institution like Gary talked about, it isn't going to work unless they follow up in the community, because they need to deal with their chemical dependency issues in the environment in which they're going to function. Please, when we're talking about this, when you're going to talk about this at the legislature, there has to be money with that. Don't foist this on the county tax levy. There isn't enough county tax levy to do this. And I think Isabel is right. We're not talking new money. We're not talking new allocation. We're not talking new appropriation. We're talking about reallocation of existing resources. And yes, it can be done.
I think all those numbers are difficult because we saw last year when we had the courts testify about drug courts and how much it would save us with in terms of bed savings, and then they turn around and say we don't really know the answer to that. So we do need to get these numbers down, because if we're going to try some new things and we're keeping people out of prison, it would seem to me that we're going to be saving some money. So that's a whole element of it. Any last comments or questions here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'd like to thank all you for participating and taking time off from your job to do this. This is an enormous problem. I know Representative Eastland and I, since we've served on this committee, we've made a commitment to try to do something different. And we've been gathering information, and you've provided a wealth of information. And I think we're not going to solve it all in one legislative session, but I think we can try some things. And I think the Department of Corrections can do some things without necessarily our approval, and so we need to continue that dialogue. I'd also like to thank Libby Wyrum and Melanie Lacombe, staff, and Gary Carter for all your help with these meetings. And I would like to have us reconvene at some point, if you're open to it, in January, and we're going to compile all of your recommendations and see if we can't come up with a skeleton of a bill that politically might pass. Thank you all very much.